from KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Sometimes a donut is more than just a donut. Actually, for those of us who love food and have been reporting on it in some capacity for years, we know that food is always more than just a bunch of delicious bites. That's why we were thrilled to see Southern California food writer Jean Trin receive a James Beard nomination for her essay, How These Chinese Donuts Helped Save My Refugee Family, which ran in the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, Jean.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so happy, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
For our listeners who may or may not have read your piece, can you describe the crullers in question? They're not the, you know, Dunkin'-style donuts many Americans will think of when they hear the word cruller.
Yeah, so in Mandarin, they go by the name youtiao, or in my Chinese dialect of Teochew, they're called yuchakoi. They go by many, many names, and basically they're more savory rather than sweet donuts. They're basically these two strips of dough that are stuck together, and they kind of when you deep fry them, they sort of look like spread out puffy butterfly wings. And so what makes them delicious is that they're, you know, soft and chewy on the inside, kind of airy. And on the outside, they're super crispy because they're deep fried. And they have like a little bit of salt, but they're actually pretty plain.
And they're enormous. You feel like you won the lottery when you get one.
They're often the length of a forearm.
Yeah, they're really impressive. Could I ask you to read a paragraph from your essay?
Sure. But when the brutal Khmer Rouge regime took over Cambodia, my family embarked on a journey where the Chinese donut would essentially save their lives. The soldiers stormed through my parents' bustling city on April 17, 1975, forcing them and everyone else out of their homes into the countryside. At the time, my mother and father, who were 25 and 35 respectively, had two young children. They were able to bring only enough clothes, supplies, and food for 3 days.
What was the next step in your parents' journey? You hadn't been born yet, right?
Yeah, I wasn't born yet. I wasn't born until they immigrated to America. After that, they basically were wandering between Cambodia and Vietnam. They were basically homeless during that time. And they were just seeing this brutal Khmer Rouge regime. You know, were murdering people and families were torn apart. So they were in between this place for like 2 months. And then they finally made the decision to go over to a refugee camp right at the Cambodia-Vietnam border.
And how long did they spend there?
They spent about a year there.
And was your dad able to get work?
You know, during that time when they were at the refugee camp, they barely got enough to eat. But then, luckily, a friend of my parents recommended my dad for a job in Saigon in Vietnam, where his job was to basically boil water for a coffee shop.
That's amazing. Boiling water. Is that where he learned to prepare the Chinese donuts?
Yeah, that's where he actually would watch the chef there prepare Chinese donuts every day. And he kind of stored that knowledge in his head, but he didn't know at the time what that would lead to.
And you say that he eventually bought a bicycle and became a middleman bringing donuts to restaurants.
Yes, that was like his humble beginnings. My parents had managed to get enough money from work and also a little bit of cash from my mother's aunt to buy that bicycle. And then, but eventually they were able to make enough money to buy woks and stoves and flour to make their own donuts.
How long did your family end up living in Saigon, and how successful was that donut business?
They lived in Saigon for 4 years, and their business was so successful that they were able to make enough money to live on. And my mom had told me that what they made, you know, in a day is what some people made in a month.
How many donuts a day were they making?
They were making at least 500, though my mom told me sometimes that would go up to 800.
And tell us how people eat these crullers.
So they're eaten in a variety of ways. So you can dunk them in some Vietnamese coffee. You can cut them into little slices and put soy sauce on them and eat them with rice porridge. Sometimes they accompany noodles, noodle soups. Sometimes they accompany noodle soups. You can dunk them in those as well.
So they were having sort of this golden period of prosperity, but what happened in 1979?
So in 1979, they heard that the Vietnamese government were cracking down on Cambodian nationals living in Saigon. And basically, people were getting sent back to that refugee camp at the Cambodia-Vietnam border where my parents were languishing. And my parents didn't want to be stuck in that again. So they basically went on a really intense journey back through Cambodia to Thailand, where there was another refugee camp that they wanted to get into.
And then I understand that finally, a couple years later, a Wisconsin church sponsored your parents to come to the U.S.
Yes, that's correct. In 1981, they were sponsored by the Red Cross, and then they got on a plane and they arrived in Milwaukee in December, right in the middle of winter, which they had never seen snow in their lives before.
It's just inconceivable. These kind of stories are just epic. Every individual that goes through them, it's just such an epic journey. Did your parents continue to make Chinese crullers once they had settled a bit in the States?
Yes, they did. And it's become a ritual in our family. It's something they make all the time. And whenever we have gatherings, they'll make a huge amount and then they'll split it up between all the kids and the grandkids. And so it's like a huge celebration whenever we do eat them.
You write in your essay, "My family's story runs parallel to the Chinese donut's origin." What do you mean by that?
So with my parents' story and with the origin of the Chinese donuts, both have roots in political upheaval. So there's this old story about how the cruller or Chinese donut was even created. So it was back in the day in China's Southern Song Dynasty, that was in the 12th century. So there was a war hero that was believed to be executed unjustly. And it was caused by the lies of a chancellor. So supporters of this war hero, as a way to deal with their anger and sadness, they attached two pieces of dough to represent that chancellor and his wife, and they fried it in boiling oil as just a way to like express how they were feeling.
Wow. Well, tonight is the big night in Chicago, where the media portion of the James Beard Awards will take place. The Good Food team will be rooting for you, Jean. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was food writer Jean Trinh discussing her LA Times essay, "How These Chinese Donuts Helped Save My Refugee Family." It was recently nominated for a James Beard Award in the Personal Essay Without Recipes category. You'll find a link to it on our website, KCRW.com/goodfood.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Count us amongst the legions of Andrea Wynn fans, a prolific cookbook writer and teacher known for recipes that work. I love her sense of humor and her deep knowledge of the subject, which centers the Viet World Kitchen, the name of her website. Andrea's latest cookbook is Evergreen Vietnamese, which takes a plant-focused look at the food of her home country. Hello, Andrea.
Hello, Evan. How are you?
Oh, it's been way too long. I'm so grateful that you wrote a book, that you wrote a whole book so we can talk to each other.
Just, I have to stir the pot, Evan, you know, every once in a while.
Yeah, this is an interesting pot for you to stir. Why evergreen Why now? And does that mean no animal proteins at all?
No animal protein is not how I eat and cook. And Evergreen is about my approach to sustainable health and, you know, for my own well-being and for the planet. And so, you know, the Evergreen part is about enduring ideas in the Vietnamese kitchen. And that is the notion, really, pretty much of just centering plants on the plate, in the bowl, so to speak, in your rice bowl.
So I'm so curious about the collection of recipes. When you started to approach it, did you look for traditional ones that happened to be plant-based, or did you take traditional ones and sort of evolve them into a different kind of standard?
I'm taking door number two that because I thought to myself, you know, when I started on this project, my publisher was like, you know what, we can sell a Vietnamese vegetarian cookbook. And I said, that's great, but I can't write that book because I'm not a vegetarian. But I understand the needs of vegetarian cooks. And one of the questions that's always been presented to me is, what the heck are you going to do about fish sauce? So when I started on this project, I thought to myself, I need to figure out a way to get around the elephant in the kitchen, so to speak, which is a bottle of fish sauce. And so I came up with a vegan fish sauce recipe that I kind of reverse engineered from what I consider to be very good vegan fish sauce that comes out of Vietnam.
And I was really fascinated that you went to the trouble of creating a vegan fish sauce recipe, because surely there must be some industrial fish sauce products out there that are created for the vegan market.
There are. And the ones that I've tried that come from mainstream markets are honestly so bland and off the mark. And they're expensive. And the ones that are available at Vietnamese markets, you know, they're good, but they're hard to find for people. And they have certain additives in there that I don't care for. So I thought to myself, can I use ingredients that are pretty much at my disposal to come up with a vegan fish sauce that's a one-to-one swap with regular fish sauce? And holy smokes, I did. So
just, you don't have to take us through the recipe in detail, but give us an idea of what some of the major players are in the recipe. And is it a fermented product?
No, it's not fermented. The foundation is seaweed and pineapple juice.
Wow.
I know. I said the same thing, Evan. It's like remarkable, because once you go through the motions of making the fish sauce, the vegan fish sauce, you go, oh, wow, you know, canned pineapple juice has this kind of fermenty tang. And then once that you combine it with seaweed, it presents itself as this briny fermented sauce from the sea, almost like a sea sauce. And the salinity comes from salt and a flavor enhancer.
Wow, that's just so fabulous. So I would like to ask you about another condiment, because of course, there are so many condiments in your book, not only condiments that we think of as something we add after the dish is done, but condiments that are used in the cooking itself. But I have to say that scallion oil is just like an obsession with me.
Yeah, mine too. And it's so simple, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who occasionally gives me some, and it's the greatest all-purpose condiment. But I have to say, I've never bothered to make it myself. So could you talk about the garlicky green onion sizzle that you have?
You know, you got to have like sexy names, you know, to catch readers. And yeah, it is a sizzle. And what that, there's a lot of scallion oil or green onion oil. We call it in Vietnamese Han Mo or Mo Han, and which is like, it refers to fatty green onions because it's typically made with like lard, but oil works fine. And you would heat up oil and throw a bunch of green onions in there, but I add garlic to it too, as well as some fish sauce And to hold the color, I will add a little bit, a pinch of baking soda, just to like hold the green color. And then there is chili in there as well. And it's a sauce that I keep around, and in the book, I put it on grilled eggplant.
Oh, which just sounds divine.
It's a great summer thing. It's great all around. And the eggplant kind of, you know, once that you start cooking with a lot of vegetables, you pay attention to their personalities in ways that you don't otherwise. So with the eggplant, when I started grilling really like thick slabs of eggplant and just eating it on its own with that scallion garlic sizzle, I had this thing of like, oh gosh, eggplant can cook up to like this super rich lusciousness, almost like the fat in pork belly.
Yes. Yes.
You know, it's like vegetarians may not always use descriptors like that for vegetables, but I'm an omnivore. And so I look at that eggplant, I'm like, God, you know, that reminds me of that. Or a king trumpet mushroom. Boy, it's kind of like the firmness and texture of chicken thighs or chicken drumsticks. And so it becomes really fun for me as a cook. And I think that it's a great way for people to plug into using vegetables in the kitchen without, you know, making it seem like it's this very strict, arduous thing that you have to kind of be religious about.
I want to talk about cauliflower for a minute because I think all of us are looking for something new to do with cauliflower all the time. Tell us about the char siu roasted version that you have.
Well, that was something that I thought to myself, people have roasted cauliflower in all different ways, cauliflower steaks, but why hasn't there been many cauliflowers done char siu style? And then I was like, well, I'll do it. And it's such a simple recipe, but one of the things I wanted to do with that is to prep the cauliflower in a way where there is like minimal waste. So I cut them into wedges so that, you know, you're not just cutting steaks. And then there's always that thing of where recipes say, oh gosh, well, just save the other parts, the little crumbly parts for other recipes. And my thought's like, what are those other recipes? And so I cut them into wedges and the instructions, I don't know, so many people went through them because it's kind of a funny way to cut up a cauliflower. But then the wedges are roasted in this very simple char siu seasoning sauce. And what happens, oddly, well, not oddly, this is natural, the cauliflower releases all of this liquid and then it concentrates. It cooks down in the hot oven, and then I have people just kind of like swipe the cauliflower through the seasoning sauce as it's concentrating, and then it kind of sticks to the char siu. Because typically with char siu, you're basting the meat with the marinade or the seasoning sauce throughout the cooking process. And I didn't want to do that. I was like looking at this liquid and I thought to myself, just let it cook. And then it just kind of evaporates and kind of does the work for you. So it's very similar and it comes out like having this chewy, meaty quality. And it's so much fun to make.
It sounds really fun. So let's talk about the cake. It's what your husband calls the cake.
He calls it the cake. My mom just calls it the Vietnamese coffee cake, and it's a mocha cake. Because I started out thinking, you know, it'd be so great to make Vietnamese coffee cake, but not really a coffee cake in the traditional American sense.
A cake that was Vietnamese coffee in solid form.
Right. It tastes like Vietnamese coffee. I thought, oh, it'd be so great, so easy. But it turns out that when you bake a cake with condensed milk, like a regular kind of layer cake, kind of, you know, that kind of cake, because I've seen pound cake recipes that use condensed milk. But just like a regular dump and stir cake with condensed milk, it's not so easy to make something like that. And I went at least 30 rounds and before I got it right. And we were in the middle of a kitchen remodel. And so the guys would come and, you know, around 8:30 or 9, but I would wake up early in the morning before they got to my house. I would plug the stove back in because I had it on wheels. And I would bake off, you know, a test trial of the cake and see what happens. And then if it worked out all right, someone would on the construction crew would get cake. My neighbors got the cake too, but it is a cake that tastes like Vietnamese coffee, and it's absolutely delicious. And that's something that my neighbors and my mother continually ate with no complaints.
Oh, I'm you know, the downside to doing this job is if one doesn't eat before, one gets very hungry.
You know, it is the problem when we talk about food and when we work in food is that it is so enticing.
It is so enticing. And this whole book is just gorgeous, I have to say. The whole thing is enticing.
Well, thank you. I worked on it with a legendary editor named Lorena Jones, whom I've known since I started my career in food writing. She recently retired after 30 years in the industry, and this was the last book that she edited. And we wanted to make a book that was substantive. And I'll tell you, you know, this is the only vegetarian Vietnamese book that I'll ever write. And it's mostly vegetarian for folks who wonder, because I've had those questions. But it's a vegetarian or vegetable-centric book that's for everyone. Because there's like so much, you know, we talk about healthy eating and oftentimes it's centered on the Mediterranean diet, which I absolutely love. But there are a lot of really healthy, fun things that you can do with Asian cuisines as well. And so that's the promise behind Evergreen Vietnamese, and I hope it delivers.
Thank you so much, Andrea.
Oh, thank you so much, Evans. Always such a pleasure to chat with you.
You too. That was the fabulous Andrea Nguyen. Her latest book is Evergreen Vietnamese, Super Fresh Recipes, Storing Plants from Land and Sea. Head to our website for recipes for both her cauliflower char siu recipe and that delicious Vietnamese mocha cake. It's all at kcrw.com/goodfood. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Is there anything more comforting than a slow and low-braised dish? Bill Addison says, perhaps not. The LA Times restaurant critic is here with a tip on what may become your next go-to comfort food restaurant. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to have you back. Where are you taking us this week?
We are headed to the San Gabriel Valley and specifically to Arcadia.
And I understand we're going to a restaurant called Lu Yi Shan. Who are the couple behind it and what is their background in restaurants?
Yeah, this is the first restaurant in America from Chun Hua Tao and her husband Yao Yi, who is the chef. They both grew up in the Zhaojiang province of East China, a coastal stretch that's south of Shanghai. They operated restaurants in the area where they grew up for more than 20 years before opening Lu Yi Shan.
So tell us a little bit about the culinary approach of the couple. In your review, you said that it helps to break down the name of the restaurant. Could you do that for us?
Sure. So in both Mandarin and Cantonese, Lu, phonetically spelled in English, L-U, is the word for braising, which in the context of Chinese cuisines, we're broadly referring to the technique of simmering foods and highly seasoned soy-based liquid. My buddy, Lee F. Mann, who lives in Vancouver and often helps me with the fine points of Chinese cuisines, kindly translated the rest of the name of the restaurant for me. He told me that Yi, phonetically spelled Y-E, means 100 million, and the last character is Xian, which is cuisine or food. So it all comes together, Lu Yi Xian, as a restaurant serving a wide variety of Lu dishes, or braised dishes.
I love that.
Yeah, it's cool.
So walk us through the menu and explain some of the regional overlap of dishes.
It's a big menu. It's one of those booklets. And the couple does hop around, regionally speaking, with some of the dishes they serve. There are Sichuan-style cold meats and boiled fish and scarlet broth that's so popular in the San Gabriel Valley in the advent of all the Sichuan restaurants over the last decade. There's a spicy beef noodle soup that reminds you of versions that I love in Taiwanese restaurants. And there are vegetables like garlic water, spinach, tinged with a bit of fermented tofu that a Cantonese friend that I brought said that it tasted like home to her. But of course, the couple also serves dishes that are specific to their region. And that's where these braised dishes really come in.
Could you talk about a couple of the different braised dishes and where you would point us on the menu?
Absolutely. So the one essential dish that I sort of recommend everyone who thinks about coming to this restaurant and eats meat should try is the number 44. It's a beautiful kind of soothing collage of ingredients presented on an oblong platter. There's a mound of white rice that's pre-sauced with a spoonful or two of braising gravy. And it sidles up to a heap of brown glazed pork belly, chopped into bite-sized squares. And there are all these wonderful condiments, snipped and pickled long beans, some braised cabbage, a spoonful of minced red chili, and a soy braised egg on the side as well. When the dish arrived the first time I was eating at the restaurant, I looked down and I said, "Oh, like Lu Ru Fan?" And they nodded. And that's, we're talking essentially about a braised pork dish over rice that is one of the national staples of Taiwanese cuisine. And it has many interpretations, and the couple certainly acknowledges that the style that they make their Lu Ru Fan is reminiscent of family recipes from their area, but it is this kind of, you know, wonderful, comforting, ubiquitous dish, and their version is amazing.
And we might have had versions at Pine and Crane and Joy.
Exactly, yes. And I love those versions. Those are two restaurants from Vivian Koo. Pine and Crane has locations in Silver Lake and downtown, and Joy is in Highland Park. Both of those versions at those restaurants are simpler. We're talking kind of a more basic, like ground meat, delicious over egg and served with pickled daikon and a tea egg. Great for a quick, straightforward meal, but also at Joy and specifically a Pine and Crane, like great as part of a group of dishes, like three cup chicken and wonton soup and the greens that are grown on a farm by Koo's relatives.
So going back to Lu Yishan, when is the restaurant open? What are their hours?
They keep long hours. The restaurant is open 11 a.m. to midnight, and I hope they don't burn out because this is a great new place in the SGV.
Well, thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks, Evan.
That was Los Angeles Times restaurant critic Bill Addison sharing his thoughts on Lu Yishan in Alhambra. The restaurant can be tricky to find on your first visit, so Bill says to look for the entrance in the far corner of the small parking lot behind the sprawling buildings at the intersection of South Garfield and Valley Boulevards. Before you go, head to our website for a link to Bill's full review. You know the link. It's kcrw.com/goodfood. It's that time when we head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this first week of June in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. It is such a pleasure to be here at the market with Evan Funky this morning. Evan is the chef behind Felix in Venice, Motherwolf in Hollywood, and the latest in his trilogy is Funky in Beverly Hills. Hello, chef.
Good morning.
So I just want to tell you how impressive it is that you run three impossibly busy restaurants here in Los Angeles and that you're here at the market every Wednesday morning.
So there's only one place to get vegetables.
That's right. And it feels like the right time to open an Italian restaurant in LA because we are still elbow deep in spring vegetables here.
Absolutely. It's always the right time to open an Italian restaurant, no matter what season it is.
I came in this morning, I could smell the fava beans. We've still got asparagus. We've got artichokes. What are you most excited about right now?
So I'm actually going to start to talk about Swiss chard. Ooh. Bietole. So it seems kind of counterintuitive to talk about Swiss chard because people think it's a fall vegetable, but there's actually two crops in California, springtime and then fall. And I love Swiss chard because it's kind of this filter for the salinity in the soil from wherever you're buying it from. So I'm buying from three different places, three different farms, three different geographic specificities. One's from Florabella, gets all the irrigation water from melting snow caps, so super high mineral content, very saline, Jimenez, and Shaner. So very different geographies, very different soil contents and water tables and whatnot. So I like this quasi-alchemy when it comes to vegetables, the different terroirs within the, you know, we'll call it peninsula of California. And if you blend the three geographies, you get a better version of the chard. And those nuances are you know, that it's tangible in the final dish.
So what is the final dish? What are you doing with Swiss chard?
So when I was shooting Shape of Pasta, we happened upon a town called Pontremoli, which is in the Lunigiana, which sits in between Tuscany and Liguria. I went to this little trattoria and had a torta di erbe, a Genovese. And it's kind of a puff pastry with Swiss chard, onions, and this cheese similar to ricotta called prisciinseua. It's kind of a cross between yogurt and ricotta, very soft. And it's this amazing balance of super flaky, very creamy, and slightly acidic. And it was so striking. So playing around at the moment at Funky to put this torta de erba on the menu. But I just wanted to shout out those three farms because they're growing Swiss chard and everybody's got, you know, knee deep in peas and favas and asparagus, which is fantastic as well.
Yeah. There's a photo on your website that will haunt me until I eat this. It is an artichoke that is blistered and charred. Yes. Tell us about that dish.
So this is the carciofi dalla carboni. It's essentially a whole coal roasted artichoke. Now, unfortunately, we were testing this the entire opening of Funky, but then the artichokes went to flower.
Oh.
So the perfect size from Finley and from Suncoast and from Tutti Frutti, they were perfect the weeks leading up to the opening, but then everything went to flower and we had to go to the Carciofi alla Giudea, which are the fried artichokes, the Jewish artichokes. So unfortunately, the size matters for this style of artichoke. This is an artichoke that I ate in the street stalls in the fish market in Catania. And there's this one guy who roasts the artichokes all day long, and they serve it to you in a piece of tin foil with lemon juice, a ton of chopped mint and chopped garlic. And it's the most spectacular street snack on earth. And I really, really, really wanted to put this on the opening menu. So the photo is there and it's a delicious dish, but the artichokes have to be perfect. And it's a very small window. And that's a lot of people don't understand the quote unquote seasons of California. There are seasons if you pay attention. And some of the windows of the seasons are very short, 3, 6, 8 weeks, and then it's gone. The other thing, just because it's in the market doesn't mean you should buy it. You should taste the market, eat the market. And that's how I learned, and this is how I teach. You've got to eat the market from beginning to end in order to understand what's good. And that harnessed sunshine that you find in a patty pan squash, like, it's going to speak to you. If you walk by it and your eye, literally the primal eye will go to that and saying, eat me, I'm ripe. Go buy that. Go eat that. And that's how I shop. Italian food is most of the times really great shopping and knowing what to buy.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Thank you.
That was Evan Funky. He is the chef behind three restaurants, Felix in Venice, Mother Wolf in Hollywood, and the brand new Funky, 18 days into service as we speak. You can find him at Funky at the Pass pretty much every night but Sunday. Dawn Birch is the farmer from Florabella Farms who brings her Swiss chard down from Three Rivers. Dawn, Evan was just saying beautiful things about your Swiss chard. I mentioned it at the table, and there was a whole chorus of voices who chimed in talking about how great it was. So tell us about your soil and what makes this Swiss chard so special.
Well, my husband says it's the soil, and we've been there 33 years, been certified organic 31 years by CCOF, and prior to it being our farm, it was a horse pasture, so there's never been chemicals on our land, and there isn't any other farmers in Three Rivers, so we're not getting any drift. I think it's the water. And our water source is snowmelt off the Sierra Nevadas. It comes down the river. It runs to our farm. We trap it right out of the river, run it through sand filters, and out into our drip. And by using drip lines rather than overhead watering, we've been able to cut our water usage probably 60% in the last 10 years. And I think it's a combination of the water, the soil, the clean location. We're not near a freeway, not a lot of cars going by. We're just in a little rural town 1,000 feet up in the Sierra Nevadas. And I think all those things together, we're able to grow how they grew 100 years ago. So hopefully this is the chard your grandparents enjoyed.
Yeah, so special. So the last time we talked, you were digging a well. There was much less water than there is now. Update us on the situation.
Our well was successful. It's a hard rock well, so it was drilled directly through the granite, and we're looking for fissures in the granite where the water is seeping in. We did hit at 495 feet, and we got 80 gallons a minute. So that is our secondary water source. It's not our favorite water source because that water's never seen the light of day. It's traveled from the back countries of the Sierras through the granite, underground, and it has a lot of minerals in it. We prefer to use the river water because it's full of organic material, and that's a more natural way to grow. And that is what really provides the best tasting produce for us.
So as we enter summer, what else are you excited about growing with all this fresh water?
Our cherry tomatoes, our heirloom tomatoes, and then our peppers will be coming. And of course, we're going to stay on top of our lovely greens. Right now, we're actually bringing purslane, which is a great weed with omega-3 fatty acids in it. Very, very healthy. And we have our basil and arugula, and, you know, we'd just be adding to it. My husband loves to grow different things.
How wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Dawn.
Thank you.
That was Dawn Birch together with her husband, James. They are the farmers behind Florabella in Three Rivers, right at the foot of Sequoia National Park. You can find them at the Wednesday and Saturday downtown farmers markets. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laryl Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and Hope Rush. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. For those of you listening via podcast, you might have realized it's a shorter show this week. That's because KCRW, which produces this show, is in the middle of our SOS pledge drive. That is our Save Our Summer pledge drive. I'm here with KCRW's president, Jennifer Farrow, and we're asking for your support today.
We rarely do this kind of thing in June, so apologies. We only do it if we need to, and we need to this month. And it's, again, not a mystery. There's a lot of media companies going through something similar to what we're going through. But look, we want you to invest in this incredible place called KCRW, the place that has a pie contest where 10,000 people show up. And really, did you know that? I don't know. I'm sure you talked about it. But if you heard us talking about the pie contest, we held it at UCLA in April, and we were overwhelmed with the response to people coming to this pie contest. It was a beautiful thing. And I talked to someone before about that. They were like, I didn't know I wanted to come to a pie contest. And I'm like, it wasn't about the pie. It was about the community that comes together around the events that KCRW throws. And it's inspired by this show, which is what I love, because it came out of the brain of Evan Kleiman. But what we're asking you to do is support KCRW.
You can go to kcrw.com/give to make a donation. And if you could make that donation monthly, more is the better. Thank you so much. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.